Thanks for tuning in for the May 5th podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals. Neurology, Neurology Genetics, Neurology, Neuroimmunology and Neuroinflammation, and Neurology Clinical Practice. This week's featured interview is on epilepsy and the elderly. In the other segment, you'll hear a discussion on the use of a type of transcutaneous electrical nerve stimulator in patients with NMO and central neuropathic pain.
Welcome to this week's What's Trending interview. I'm Jeff Ratliff from Jefferson University. In this week's interview, we're talking with my fellow Jefferson colleague, Scott Mintzer. Scott's an epilepsy neurologist here at Jefferson who we wanted to bring onto the podcast. I had admitted a patient of mine to our epilepsy monitoring unit here at Jefferson that Scott helped care for. We were talking about how EEG and other clinical factors surrounding seizures and epilepsy may be a little different than the general population. In our conversation, it seemed to me that perhaps we should adjust our clinical considerations when it comes to more elderly patients with regards to seizures and epilepsy. Rather than just me benefit from Scott's advice and knowledge, we thought it'd be great to bring him on the podcast and have a discussion about it. Welcome, Scott, to the podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Scott, I want to first start with a hypothetical scenario. Let's say we're seeing a 75-year-old without any known prior neurologic disease who comes in after a new episode in which the family's concerned about loss of consciousness or loss of awareness. Common things being common, how high should seizure be in our differential in that case? We've probably already considered other cardiovascular causes of loss of consciousness. So given that, how common is it for us to see new seizures in patients in their 60s, 70s, or older? Is this something our listeners are likely to come across?
The short answer is yes, this is definitely something your listeners are likely to come across. It's an underappreciated fact by doctors in general and by neurologists specifically that new onset of seizures in the elderly is actually extremely common. If you look at the epidemiologic data, of course, there's a large number of patients who have onset of epilepsy in childhood. Then it tails off a whole lot during midlife where the incidence goes down a whole bunch. And then it just starts skyrocketing again when people get into their, like 60s, 70s, 80s. It's actually tremendously common. So, of course, syncope is going to be a lot more common than seizures just because syncope is so common in the elderly. But this is definitely something that your listeners are likely to encounter.
And so for those of us who have a clinical practice in which we see patients who are more elderly, perhaps this is a cognitive neurology or a movement disorder practice, in patients who present there, we may be asked by our patients if any new seizures are related to their underlying neurodegenerative disorder. What do we know about epilepsy and the common neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's?
So I'm not aware of any increase in the frequency of seizures in patients with Parkinsonian syndromes. In fact, there was this old saw that Parkinsonism made you resistant to epilepsy in some way. And to be honest, I'm not entirely sure where that came from. And I have seen enough patients with Parkinson's disease who had seizures that I no longer believe that. But by the same token, I don't think there's an increased risk for any of the basal ganglia-related syndromes. Now, when you're talking about, let's say, Alzheimer's disease, there's some very interesting data about very elevated incidence of temporal spikes in Alzheimer's disease patients. Obviously, Alzheimer's disease affects the temporal lobe predominantly, and that's the most common spot for focal seizures to arise. I think it's at least reasonable to suspect that there's some increase in the incidence. As far as other neurodegenerative diseases go, like, frontotemporal dementia and things like that, I'm not aware of any data of an increase in the risk. But the thing is, this increase in the incidence of seizures in the elderly that we know epidemiologically, we presume that this is either due to cerebrovascular disease or neurodegenerative disease or both. It certainly wouldn't surprise me to see more seizures in these patients.
So if we take out the pre-existing neurologic conditions and talk about elderly patients without known comorbid neurologic disease who are presenting with a new seizure, do all the same rules apply in terms of our differential and workup that would apply in a younger adult? Do we still get an EEG and brain imaging? Are there pitfalls in the standard workup that we're all familiar with?
So the answer is you're going to do the same workup in an elderly patient with suspected seizures. problem is that some of the data may be less useful to you. In particular, the EEG may be less useful. And that's because EEG spikes go down steadily and are seen less and less frequently as patients get older. I think a lot of people are aware of the fact that kids with epilepsy spike like crazy, and in adults, they spike less often. If you take 100 elderly patients with known epilepsy and do a sleep-deprived EEG on all of them, the percentage who are going to actually have spikes in that EEG is about 30%. So what that means is you're going to have to rely even more on your history than you did before. You always need to when you're dealing with epilepsy because it is all about the history. But when you have those ambiguous cases where the history tells you, well, maybe this was a seizure, maybe it wasn't, I'm not entirely sure, and you're relying on the EEG to help make that determination for you, in the elderly, you're not going to tend to get that reinforcement, at least in terms of temporal spikes. Now, one thing that you can see that I find a whole lot is that elderly patients with epilepsy seem to pretty often have what we call TIRDA, which stands for temporal intermittent rhythmic delta activity. And that's a particular kind of temporal slowing. And that particular kind of temporal slowing has been noted clinically and has been shown in the literature to be associated with temporal lobe seizures. What I seem to find, and this is my own anecdotal evidence, I don't have data on this, is that a lot of elderly with seizures seem to have TIRDA instead of temporal spikes. And when I see TIRDA, that's as good as seeing temporal spikes as far as I'm concerned. That will push me toward believing that the episodes in question were seizures, and I'll go ahead and treat the patient. But you're also just going to see a lot more negative EEGs in patients with epilepsy, and you're just going to have to make your judgments clinically.
Let's move from suspicion of seizures to making that diagnosis of epilepsy. Perhaps there's been two episodes that have been convincing for seizures by your careful history, or we're actually seeing some of the more rare EEG abnormalities like TIRDA or spikes that you taught us about. How might a patient's advanced age affect our treatment decisions that you alluded to? I imagine that anticonvulsant medication side effects may need to be even more carefully considered, but is there more that goes into our considerations about treatment choice and even treatment response?
Well, first thing to say is regarding treatment response, patients with new seizures at advanced ages seem to be overall a very easy population to treat. We infer that in the epilepsy world in part because we don't see that many of these patients. So we believe they're just effectively treated with whatever, you know, their local neurologists are treating them with, so they don't even get to us. In my own personal experience, when I do get elderly patients with new onset epilepsy, the large majority are very readily treated. I have one or two patients who've had elderly onset epilepsy who are difficult to treat in my practice. It is distinctly unusual. So these people, by and large, do very well. In terms of the specifics of treatment considerations, on the one hand, you want to be aggressive about treating any convulsive seizures or any seizures where the patient falls, because obviously in an older patient, they fall once, they could break their hip, and that could be game over. And so you really, really don't want that next seizure to happen if they're falling with them. By the same token, elderly patients are very prone to drug side effects. They don't metabolize drugs as well, and they're on all sorts of other things. So there are some specific treatment considerations and some things that are important for everybody, but even more important in the elderly. One thing that I would urge your listeners to do is to absolutely avoid using drugs that have drug interactions. I'm specifically talking about the enzyme-inducing drugs, phenytoin, carbamazepine, phenobarbital, primidone. These drugs are going to wreak havoc with the patient's other medical conditions, even if you effectively treat their seizures. There's also valproate, which is not an enzyme inducer, it's an enzyme inhibitor, but also has a lot of drug interactions. And all of these drugs are also very metabolically dirty. They are bad for bone density. The enzyme inducers all raise cholesterol. They are really drugs that you want to avoid using in elderly patients. With regard to other drugs, I would advise using doses that are on the lower end of the scale because, as I mentioned, elderly patients just don't metabolize drugs as well, and they're just going to get side effects at lower doses. One particular example that's worth noting is levetiracetam. Just seems to very reliably make elderly patients fatigued in a way that it just doesn't in younger patients. I feel like most of the elderly patients I put on levetiracetam 500 BID wind up feeling tired. And then you could try to get away with 250 BID or just end up putting them on something else. When I use lamotrigine, that's a drug where I check drug levels, the doses that I'm going to use to get therapeutic levels end up being at the low end of the dosing schedule. Sometimes even 50, 75 BID might be enough, whereas in older patients, I'm going for 100 or 150 BID or more. Oxcarbazepine, you want to watch out for hyponatremia because a lot of these patients are on diuretics, and that's a risk factor for hyponatremia with oxcarb. So whichever drug you're using, you want to shoot for the lower end of the dosage scale because they just won't need higher doses and because they are very prone to side effects. And I think those are the major treatment considerations.
Thanks, Scott. I think this has been really informative, both in terms of thinking about some of the considerations on anorectal EEG, but also really carefully considering the drug interactions at play when we're prescribing. I want to encourage our listeners to consider some of those diagnostic issues we discuss next time they're consulted for possible new seizures. And again, consider those drug selection issues after they've made a diagnosis of epilepsy. Scott, thanks again. I think this has been really educational.
Thanks, Jeff. It was my pleasure.
Welcome to this week's featured interview. This is Jeff Ratliff from Jefferson University. In this week's interview, we are welcoming Maureen Mealy. Dr. Mealy is a nurse and researcher with an appointment at Johns Hopkins University, who also works for Viela Bio. Maureen and her colleagues published a study titled Scrambler Therapy Improves Pain in Neuromyelitis Optica, a Randomized Controlled Trial. In her study, Maureen and her collaborators aim to find out if scrambler therapy is helpful for centrally mediated pain in patients with neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder. The results of the study were published in the most recent issue of Neurology coming out May 5th. Maureen, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you for inviting me.
I want to set the stage a little bit before we talk about the study. Can you teach us about scrambler therapy? From reading the paper, I understand it's a non-invasive technology. It provides transcutaneous stimulation of peripheral nerves in an attempt and therapy for pain modulation. What do our general neurologist listeners or even subspecialist neurology listeners need to know about where and when this therapy is typically deployed in the patients we see?
So you're exactly right. Scrambler is a type of TENS. It uses peripheral nerve stimulation to modify ascending sensory responses in the spinal cord. Traditional TENS takes advantage of the gate control theory, in which stimulation of surrounding A-delta fibers dampens incoming pain signals. So in general, when you think of all the different types of nerve signals traveling back and forth from the body through the spinal cord into the brain, it's so much information and pain signals just don't get prioritized by our nervous system. Touch, for example, is more highly prioritized and TENS provides that touch input, which enables the brain to then dampen the pain input. Now, scrambler therapy goes a step further. It's thought to provide stimulation directly to the C fibers, and it imitates normal nerve action potentials with the intent of reorganizing maladaptive signaling pathways. And it does so through so-called scrambled waveforms. So instead of the repetitive, identical waveforms that are emitted in traditional TENS, the idea is that the information gets interpreted by the brain to replace pain with no pain information through these scrambled waveforms. And then the expectation is that this might allow for longer suppression of pain as compared to some studies which suggest TENS might be better for acute pain, more so than chronic pain. So prior to the study, there had been active research in peripheral neuropathic pain with scrambler therapy. So if you look in the literature, the application of this technology really started in cancer patients who developed chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy, where mostly open label studies suggest that patients can have significantly reduced pain or even be pain-free for up to 3 months following a series of treatments, and that follow-up treatments usually require fewer sessions for continued relief. So my mission really was to introduce and test this technology for central neuropathic pain, and specifically with patients with NMO, because care of these patients and this population is really my passion. And to that end, our clinic looked at the utility in a couple of patients with central pain that provided proof of concept to support the current study. And before this, there weren't any studies that looked at the role of scrambler in central neuropathic pain.
I do want to talk about NMO. I want to ask a little bit from a practical standpoint.
how is this done? Is scrambler therapy typically available at tertiary clinics, or do we refer patients to pain management clinics? How accessible is it to the general neurologist or community neurologist who wants to use this therapy for one of their patients who's struggling with painful neuropathy or some other pain syndrome?
Yeah, it's an important question because nowadays you can get a traditional TENS unit off of Amazon.com or even, you know, at your local drugstore and apply it. And so the accessibility of a traditional TENS unit is far and away superior to the accessibility of scrambler therapy. While the device is cleared for use by the FDA, there's no procedure code associated with it. And so reimbursement by insurance companies and Medicare can be challenging. And then some studies have shown that there's really a technician bias in terms of response to therapy can be technician dependent, which also offers a challenge in terms of it being very widely available. There are clinics that perform this treatment throughout the country, but it's a select few. And mostly these clinics are those that treat cancer pain. Scrambler therapy really gained its footing in oncology, but even some neurologists are starting to develop treatment programs. And then there are some freestanding pain clinics that offer this treatment. Different institutions have different approaches to billing for the therapy, anywhere from having patients pay the whole cost out of pocket. And we didn't get into this, but this requires 10 treatments over 2 weeks. So basically every day for 2 weeks during the week, Monday through Friday, you receive treatment. The treatment's quick. You know, the first day is usually a little longer, but oftentimes the subsequent treatments just need to be a half hour or so. But it does require a visit to a facility that has this technology available. And then some places, they will just bill for the provider's time only. And then others really only deliver the treatment under research protocol. So it does limit access. The hope is that as more promising research is done and disseminated, the approach to pain treatment will become more widely available.
And that's exactly what I was going to say. It sounds like we need to do more studies so that we can start to prove that this is a good therapy outside of the oncology patients who seem to have been the ones that have used it most often up until now. And so given that, let's bring in neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder. I don't commonly see NMO in my clinical practice unless it's on our consult service, perhaps. What do I need to know about the symptom of pain in neuromyelitis optica for the few NMO patients I do end up seeing down the road?
Sure, yeah. So we all know that NMO has a predilection to cause attacks in the optic nerves and spinal cord, leading to blindness and paralysis. But the destruction of the spinal cord in NMO also causes pain following the attacks in the subacute and chronic stages following attacks. In fact, despite the devastating impact of this disease on vision and mobility, patients have reported that pain is among the most pervasive and debilitating symptom. It affects 62 to 91% of patients with NMO. It's been shown to impact mood, mobility, quality of life, and it's really been shown to be intractable to the commonly used treatments. So there's no standard of care for treatment of central neuropathic pain in NMO, but we tend to use what they use for peripheral neuropathy. So off-label medications, anti-epileptics and antidepressants and anti-inflammatories. Similar to what we also use in MS, but descriptive studies recognize that these medications are inadequate. Even compared to patients with MS who can respond quite well to these medications, NMO patients don't. And that results in polypharmacy and frequent breakthrough opioid use. And now, despite the significant unmet need for treatment of central neuropathic pain, there's nothing before in the literature that has investigated any pharmacologic or non-pharmacologic interventions until this study for pain management in NMO.
So it does sound like we need both pharmacologic and non-pharmacologic therapies for pain related to neuromyelitis optica. And hopefully the non-pharmacologic therapies might be better tolerated from a side effect standpoint. So we've talked about scrambler. We've now talked about pain and NMO. I understand you studied patients with NMO-related pain with either scrambler therapy or a sham therapy. What did your team learn about the application of scrambler therapy for patients with neuromyelitis optica?
Yep. So we enrolled 22 patients with persistent neuropathic pain resulting from NMO to receive scrambler versus sham, like you said, 11 per arm into this randomized controlled trial. We looked at feasibility, acceptability of treatment, as well as safety and effectiveness. And so to those ends, we looked at things including adherence to visit schedule, comparison of adverse events between groups, and then degree of improvement in pain between the two groups at the end of treatment and down the line. We found that treatment was acceptable and feasible and seemed to be very safe. No serious adverse events in the treated group and really no adverse events that were thought to be related to treatment. And then following the 10-day treatment protocol, the median numeric pain rating, so we looked at, you know, your normal Likert scale 0 to 10, asking patients what their pain is at that moment. And the rating dropped from a median rating of 5 to 1.5 in the scrambler group following treatments, whereas the median pain score in the sham group went from 5 to 4. In fact, 4 of the 11 treated patients went on to have a pain score of 0, so they were completely pain-free having gone through the treatments. And we also explored some other co-occurring symptoms and found that depression scores decreased following treatment as well. So I'd say the response was, in my view, impressive enough that I think it warrants further exploration.
What do we do next with this data? Are we ready for prime time? Should our listeners start looking for, be it an oncology clinic or a pain clinic in their area that could apply this therapy? Are there more steps to come? What's next in terms of our need to study this or our ability to implement it for our patients?
I think our study gives us a great indication that these types of therapies have real untapped potential to affect patients' lives. And I think knowledge about scrambler therapy continues to grow as more providers kind of buy into this type of an approach to pain management. We didn't have the resources in the current study to learn about how to deliver subsequent treatments. So patients only received one course of treatment. And so we weren't able to formalize protocols for what happens next. And I think that's a missing point to this study that could be looked at with further research. You know, those who work in peripheral neuropathy have found that subsequent treatments are usually needed, although fewer treatment sessions are usually needed to achieve the same amount of pain relief. So frankly, at this moment, I think practitioners need to come together to standardize this and other approaches to pain management. There's data that suggests that combining pharmacologic with non-pharmacologic interventions for pain management, whether, you know, it's necessarily scrambler or other types of therapy, have a synergistic effect. Yet in this disease where patients experience arguably the worst of the worst pain, this is the first controlled study, like I said, that's been reported in the literature. And so I just think it's understudied field. And the significance of chronic pain may be just as underappreciated by those that don't have it. But to me, I feel like scrambler isn't necessarily the answer. For people that have access to scrambler, I think that it's wonderful. I wouldn't want it to break anyone's bank, but it also opens up the idea that we don't even know, you know, there's no traditional TENS literature in NMO. And so we know from other disease states that there's been mixed results with that. But I just think there's such a huge amount of exploration that's needed to try and tackle the pain problem in these patients that just hasn't been done. And so to me, the sky's the limit in terms of trying to figure out exactly how to approach it. But we shouldn't be so narrow in our thinking in terms of just giving anti-epileptics and antidepressants and then just letting them deal with whatever's left in terms of their pain.
And I might be putting you on the spot a little bit, but given the results and given what you just said about our need to explore all the different pain control options that we have, what are you guys offering at your NMO clinic at Johns Hopkins? And how has this changed the clinical practice based on these results?
Yeah. So we're confronted with the same types of issues that oftentimes we give treatments under research protocols or else we just bill for the provider's time. So we don't bill for the treatments themselves. And again, people need to be trained in delivering this technology. And so it's not like I can just hand somebody a scrambler machine and tell them to have at it. And so that's definitely limiting as well. But right now, our treatments are delivered through the oncology center. The person who trained me in this treatment and the person who has the machines at Hopkins is a pain specialist who's within the Department of Oncology. And so that would really be the best approach is at Hopkins, a referral from the NMO TM Center to the Oncology Center.
I got it. So hopefully there's more research to come in this. Hopefully we can broaden the accessibility of this treatment if it is going to help the litany of different painful conditions that we see as neurologists. Maureen, I wanted to thank you again for joining us, teaching us about Scrambler, teaching us about your study, and hopefully we'll get to hear more from you in the future.
Okay, I appreciate so much again. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
This is Jose Merino. Please check out this week's journal, which features a study on markers of coagulation and the hemostatic activation and how they may help identify causes of cryptogenic stroke, and an article on the abnormal development of cerebellar striatal circuitry in Huntington's disease. Please take a look at this and other articles in this week's issue. Thank you again for listening and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.